Remember, you can stay up to date on the latest news with the Irish Independent WhatsApp channel.
Seachtain, an Indo-Askeilige.
Táim I mon iarachtaí a dhéanamh teacht ar a chur, agus súligam amach an seo, gur féidir é a chur in uaig ceart lena bhaintir féin.
Scíltaí, fios, tuairimí.
Tá sé dochreite nach bhféadfach ara I gcuir na meáin an cheistin a eicáil.
Bhí an talam a gnám go raibh orthchar na reachtam. Iadach sé tarrin gribhan ar chur san I lis dúhal agus gimine fnacht gór a clig sár ducha sin éachar. Ná ní bhin áon tar dorach sa sin, bhin marav.
Seachtain. Find us on all the usual podcast platforms.
Hello and you're welcome to the Big Tech Show, a special work from home edition. We're all working from home. It's a lock. This week we're going to talk about tech companies, tech services, how they're responding, whether they're the good guys or the bad guys, maybe what they could be doing better. And I'm joined by two people who would know about this sort of stuff. Brian Caulfield is very well known in Irish tech circles, venture partner Draper Esprit. He's an advocate for startups, for tech companies. Catherine O'Keefe is the director of research. I've forgotten your title, Catherine. Director of
Training and research.
At Castlebridge Associates, which is one of the countries, maybe at this point, probably the foremost privacy and information governance company in the country. Guys, very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Before I begin, I should say, as I mentioned before, I was hoping to get this magnificent edge visually here. I had this fantastic DSLR camera set up, and it is crapped out at the last minute because Zoom isn't working for me. So I'm now back to the crap MacBook Air camera. So that's why, you know. So we're all on the same playing field. Listen, I'll get into it. I'm going to talk about a few things in your respective areas. But before, just to open up, I'm kind of interested in the tech scene at the moment, particularly the way the tech industry and tech companies and tech services are regarded. I mean, in the last 2 to 3 weeks, it has struck me that tech leaders, for example, tech CEOs, they've kind of gone from being Dr. Evil to something a lot more benign. I mean, Bill Gates, who was once the Sauron of the tech world, is now donating billions of dollars of his own money for no ostensible profitable reason to try and get to try and develop a non-profit vaccine. You've got Jack Dorsey from Twitter, who's seems to be donating 28% of his wealth, $1 billion, his Square stock, for much the same purpose. Apple is making 1 million face masks every week. Even Google, who I know, Catherine, we've spoken about before, sometimes we give them a dig or two, but they've put out a lot of sort of health figures, and it wouldn't seem that they're doing that for any selfish interest. So just a quick reaction from both of you, maybe before we start. Are tech companies now the good guys?
I'd say they're the people that they were before. They're still people. And there's, you know, as people, humans, a lot of us do have a very strong impetus to want to help. That's great. But we're also seeing a lot of profiteering at the same time. And some of that is what I would call ethics washing, trying to put a nice, we'll solve COVID-19 veneer on the same data grab with no good purpose. So it's great to see people, you know, trying to chip in and do their part. One of the big worries I've had over the past few weeks watching a lot of tech startups go, okay, we'll create this new big app or gather all this data to solve COVID-19 without really properly planning, assuming that because they're successful in tech or successful in data science, that they actually have the expertise of an epidemiologist. And so we're adding a lot of noise to the signal and making things more difficult, and maybe making it more difficult for experts to get the data they need.
I mean, I'll come back to that in a minute because, I mean, you definitely have a point, but maybe might be considered to be a little bit hard, maybe harsh. Do you have a view on that, Brian, at all?
So, I mean, I think the first thing I'd say is that a lot of people who are kind of making large donations at the moment, or who are very visible, such as Bill Gates. I mean, Bill Gates made a decision several years ago that he was essentially going to donate the majority of his wealth to good causes of one kind or another. So this isn't something new for Bill Gates. And I mean, Jack Dorsey is obviously a much younger man, but he's previously donated $40 million to a variety of good causes. So I think in many cases a lot of people have been doing these things previously, but it's just getting a lot more attention now. And I think in particular in the US, in the context of, if you like, the failure of government to adequately address the crisis, you know, people are looking to kind of tech billionaires in particular as an example of kind of stepping up and trying to deal with it. You know, having said that, let's be realistic here. Jeff Bezos' total wealth is, I think, $122 billion. The U.S. government is going to throw $2.3 trillion at the problem in terms of the kind of the reboot of the economy. So, you know, in that context, Jeff Bezos' total wealth is a drop in the ocean.
I mean. A cynic might also say that the very top tech companies are kind of maybe motivated by protecting their own interests in the long term as well. You see, WhatsApp, for example, has limited the highly forward feature to one group or person rather than five. That will probably help, but maybe some might say, well, they're probably thinking ahead as well. A scenario post COVID where the regulators might be thinking WhatsApp is too powerful, or it's too it needs to be sort of reined in a little. Maybe that's part of the calculation. I mean, although I might, that's a cynical take, but maybe that is part of the calculation.
It is an important thing to think about, and WhatsApp is one thing that was a good step that probably should have been taken in regards to other disinformation. Right now we're focused on the current crisis, but the disinformation that's been spread on WhatsApp over the past few years has been a extreme concern. If you're talking about, again, Jack Dorsey's donations when it comes to giving money towards solving things in the crisis, you also have to look at the actions of Twitter and how successful have they been in reducing some of the extreme conspiracy theories that are going on all over Twitter at the moment, and the danger that is happening to people's lives because of the misinformation that's being spread. So those are actions that we are looking at. The actions we're looking at, is this something they decided to do just now that they should have done before? What are going to be the ongoing effects post the peak of this crisis? And is this the best thing that we can do now?
So I largely agree with that. I mean, I think big platform players such as Facebook and Twitter have frankly done a pretty poor job to date of kind of policing content on their platforms in any way, shape, or form. And, you know, personally, I believe that that's something that they need to do much, much better. Having said that, it's actually hard.
It's extremely difficult.
A non-trivial, both technical and ethical problem in terms of how you police speech. So this ain't easy.
It's very difficult, Catherine. And very expensive to do it properly, because it still requires human moderation. AI does not have the capability to analyze speech in the way that we think it does, as far as that goes.
Yeah,
we tend to hype it way too much.
Yeah, I mean, a colleague of mine in the journalistic world, Jess Kelly, was quite partly a victim of that during the week. So she made a complaint against a troll, but it was only a regular case of bullying and, you know, particular harassment. So therefore, she got a message back from Instagram to say, we've noted your complaint. Unfortunately, we've basically redirected resources toward COVID-19 stuff at the moment. So we will come back to it. But for the moment, you're probably going to have to, you know, you can just mute them or block them. So when you talk about resources being allocated and the amount it costs, I was on a conference call with Zuckerberg. There was about 100 of us, by the way. It wasn't me and three other people in Zuckerberg. But 3 weeks ago, when he talked specifically about this, and he was asked what Facebook's response would be. And one of the things that he was pointing out, which seemed reasonable, was that because they use a lot of contractors to try and go in and police content and on their safety team, they don't have the in-house support that the staff would have. So what they're doing is they're in-housing an awful lot of the most dangerous and most upsetting and disturbing stuff to so that they can support the people doing it. But that will have a knock-on effect, he said. They won't be as capable of dealing with that kind of stuff. So I would suspect that the point that both of you are making about policing content on platforms like Facebook is it may even get worse over the near term rather than better.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that they're in-housing the moderation, because some of the whistleblowing that's been going on, that the way that contractors were not given that support and the type of things that they're subjected to, it is, you know, traumatic. And so, you know, they need, you know, anyone doing that job needs really strong support.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I do believe there's a significant role for AI in the longer term, but I think Catherine's right that the capabilities aren't there right now to sort of hand over the problem to AI. You still need people in the loop, and those people are going to see some pretty horrendous content. I'm not sure that the problem is going to get worse. I think one of the there is, if you like, a constant level of this sort of stuff out there, but there are also spikes. And I think what we're seeing at the moment, unfortunately, is a huge spike that is driven by the COVID-19 crisis, and every business struggles to deal with massive spikes in demand. You know, I mean, this is why we've got such a big problem with PPE. You know, we suddenly need 20 times the amount of it, and it just can't be made that quick.
Mm-hmm. And yet, and this is one of the initial things I was thinking of, some of these companies are kind of stepping up to the mark. Apple's making 1 million face masks a week now. I mean, not for any profitable reason. Amazon is repurposing most of its resources towards essential or quasi-essential stuff. It's putting luxury stuff back by 3 weeks or a month. That's not necessarily in its own interest in the long term. I might be coming across a bit Pollyanna here, but I have noticed a shift in tone. I mean, for example, screens. Anytime I go on, say an RT show that's aimed at older people, the narrative is always screens are bad. The people you talk to on screens are not your real friends, right? That's been a narrative for 10 years.
It's been a narrative without any scientific evidence behind it, too.
Right. Yeah. But my point is that's kind of dissipated a little bit at the moment. All of a sudden, you know, Ryan Tuberty is doing little videos about how to use WhatsApp to talk to your parents, to your cocooners. You know, we're using Zoom. I mean, right now we're on a Zoom call, and we can talk later, Catherine, if you want, about the issues around that. But right now we're using things like Zoom to keep in touch. We're going to be doing an Easter Sunday brunch with my cocooning parents on Zoom. I'm going to put a couple of laptops and iPads around the table so we've all angles covered. But, you know, there has been a shift in tone, and I'm wondering whether we're going to see a permanent shift in tone away from this slight, I'm not going to say hysterical, because that is bejarred, but slightly judgy, tut-tutty kind of mid-market screens are never your friend.
Well, I think I think we're definitely going to see a dramatic reduction in, let's say, inertia around the adoption of a lot of these technologies. I mean, the other example for me is, you know, video consultations for GP visits. You know, the vast majority of the times you go to a GP, you really don't need to be physically present. And in a scenario like this, in actual fact, it's positively dangerous for you to be physically present if you don't need to be. And I think, you know, a lot of the inertia around adoption of technology for those type of uses will hopefully be overcome as a result of as a result of this crisis. The other big thing we're doing is we're taking a whole stack of carbon out of the atmosphere. You know, I'd be very interested to see just how much Irish emissions have collapsed over the past four weeks or so, you know. So there's something to be learned from that perspective as well.
Well, you know, that's partially because the 5G chemtrails in the sky are sort of zapping them all out of existence, you know.
Yeah, I have, despite the fact that I am very much a privacy-focused consultant, I have always been pretty early adopter when it comes to communications technology. I was using Skype in the first year it came out. As a postgrad student in Ireland with my family in the US, the communications technology leaps that we've had are wonderful. And we can't forget how they do bring us closer together. Social media, the operative word there is social. And the fact that we have the ability to connect to each other while physically isolating ourselves to try to flatten the curve, it's great. So I'm very happy about that. We do need to be very aware as well about the, inequality in access there. One of the great things about having the ability to do remote work is that, you know, it should have been available to people with disabilities who would have more difficulty to work from office situations previously. Now the excuse for denying that may be a little bit more difficult to continue with.
Yeah, it's a fair point. Out of curiosity, if you are a fan of this social technology, you would have views about some of the services we're using at the moment. Which one can you use and in good conscience? I mean, we're on Zoom at the moment. I know you have a couple of issues with that. But I mean, house party, what's your sort of privacy professional, thumbs up conferencing service of choice?
It depends on your purpose. It depends on your capabilities. And it depends on, you know, what trade-offs you're willing to make, unfortunately, because there is no one perfect one. Some of my colleagues who are heavily into privacy activism specifically talk about how you should roll your own server for Jitsi. And Jitsi is a privacy-respecting conferencing situation tool. But my colleague, who's Dara, who's a middle-aged tech geek, can't seem to get it to work himself. So you can't tell. I certainly couldn't tell my mom or my sister-in-law or my brother-in-law, who's a surfer, to conference call on Jitsi. We use FaceTime because that's what's available to them. I try to get them off of WhatsApp and onto Signal for text messages, but sometimes you can't do that. So you do what's best. When I'm lecturing, I end up using Zoom. I just try to lock down as many of the privacy functions as I can, because it is the most functional tool for that purpose right now.
It is. Brian, would you concur?
Yeah, I think if you're purely concerned with privacy, I think Jitsi probably is the platform of choice, specifically for video conferencing. Unfortunately, you're going to sacrifice a lot in terms of user experience, and these things are trade-offs. You know, that's the reality.
Yeah, we got.
So there's opportunity here for a startup that actually is able to develop a easily functional privacy respecting conferencing tools.
That's hard. I mean, I know it sounds good. It's really, I mean, the amount of time, Brian, you would have maybe a better view of that, but the amount of times that people would say there's a huge gap in the market for this service that does, you know, what this market leading service does, but does it with this, I mean, it's tough,
yeah,
right?
And the vast majority of the time, what you find out in those situations is that most of the people in the market don't give a shit, you know, and
well, this is the
thing.
They
will opt for the option that is, I mean, the other big issue here is ubiquity. You know, if you're the only person with a telephone, you're not going to be talking to a whole lot of people, you know.
Yeah.
So people will opt for the option that provides them the best user experience at the lowest cost and delivers that essential ubiquity, you know. And it's very, very tough to overcome those kind of network effects.
Yeah, I was sorry, Catherine, go on.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I noticed that none of us are using green screens on Zoom. We all right now can use a green screen if we want with our favorite, you know, holiday home thing that we're not all going to or whatever it is. All these green screens and these fantastic Zoom backgrounds, you know, have been, you know, doing the rounds for the last week. They're all crap, and it's not because the pictures are crap, but because if you actually use one of these backgrounds, you look like you're in sort of a Ukrainian Eurovision voting committee from the late 80s. You've got this fuzzy cutout around your head. It's actually shocking. I'm not sure. I don't know how any publication can recommend these things, but they do.
Yeah. No, my actual preference is that it's a nice functionality that Microsoft Teams has, which is it blurs the background a little bit.
Yeah.
And it looks a lot cleaner.
Does it looks slightly suspicious though? It looks a little bit like there's something in the back you really don't want them to see. So I mean, maybe in a professional context, that's okay because there might be sensitive data charts or something in the background. From a personal capacity, you know, I don't know.
I have to say I have found myself kind of judging people's decorative tastes on a few Zoom calls. But,
well, I think the very benign light creeping on people's backgrounds in their thing is probably just about socially acceptable. I mean, Pascal Donohue there was a picture that went around of him there the day before yesterday of him on a 15-hour conference call with other European leaders. Maybe it was to show how hard he was working, but all anybody really could focus on was on the superhero universes of little figures on his shelf. Oh, now, what I noticed about that was it was entirely Marvel and Disney. There was no DC, new DC at all. So you had Wolverine, you had all the Star Wars, but there was no DC characters at all. Now, it's a little bit sad that that's what I'm focusing on, but I kind of think that's acceptable in this climate.
It's an interesting from a theoretical and ideas of privacy that we have, the paradigms of privacy that we have right now. I think it's fascinating because what we're seeing is everyone suddenly forced to move into remote working is this real blurring of our work and public space concepts into our private space. So I've had meetings with academics where the only quiet place that the other person could set up was sitting on his bed. So in that, you're not even, it's not even a question of judging the space. It's the fact that we're bringing our work meetings into incredibly intimate areas.
We're part of a conversation there with Ray Nolan about that. I ended up writing a column. I referred to it, and it was, I had this slightly provocative view that work from home maybe wasn't all it cracked up to be, and I was going a bit stir crazy. And Ray had a different view, but he was coming at it from a different point of view, which is that choice we're now going to see. This is an enforced test, but we're going to see some of the positives from that, and hopefully we'll give more flexibility and more choice. You broadly agree with that, would you?
Yeah, I think I think it is about choice, and we should recognize that there are people, you know, living with, you know, their partner and three kids in a very small space who are finding it incredibly difficult right now. And, you know, when I talk to startup founders, I kind of get generally two versions of the story. One, this is fantastic. Everybody's really happy working from home. And the other, you know, productivity has gone through the floor because people are sort of wrangling their kids and, you know, I'd say there's probably quite a few Zoom calls that have been done sitting on toilets around the country.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just to find a quiet space. But what we are doing is, if you like, a kind of a market discovery exercise at massive scale. And there will be large numbers of people for whom this will be quite a positive experience from a work perspective, that will, you know, go back to their offices saying, you know what, I'd really like to be able to work from home 3-4 days a week and come in when I need to do meetings. Mm. And you will also have a lot of, you know, company bosses who will be saying, yeah, you know what, I never thought it would work as well as it did, but it has worked well. And, you know, do we really need 400,000 square feet of office space? Maybe 100,000 square feet is actually plenty, and people can work from home or come to the office, as is their preference.
That, I mean, I would love that. I have this kind of a fantasy of being able to drift in and out of the office, you know, as I please, maybe 3 days during the week or 4 days during the week. But I have to say, it does comfort me to know that there is an office there, there is a space there that I can go to for several hours during the day. I also have to say, the longer I spend, the older I get, the more I do respect a certain amount of organizational culture that is driven by presence. It's not just driven by virtual presence. There's a certain urgency, there's a certain discipline that's very difficult to replicate when you're doing it remotely. Catherine, you guys are largely remote, aren't you?
Castlebridge, for the first 7 years of its existence, was a virtual office. We've only had a physical office for a couple of years when we grew to have enough people that we needed to make sure we did have that ability to all be in the same room more often. And a lot of what's important there is actually developing a company culture for remote working, where you can actually have a sense of togetherness and physical presence when you're not actually in the same room with each other. So it's something that, will require organizational cultural change for long-term success of remote working. It's something that Castlebridge has had no trouble shifting to complete remote working right now, because we have that culture where we had a lot of that to begin with. It's great to be able to be in the same room with each other, though, physically present. So definitely not knocking the physical office.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. You do need to build a culture around remote working, and you need norms and kind of standards. And one thing that you have to be very careful not to do is to kind of create a sort of apartheid between those who are in the office and those who are not in the office. And that's quite tricky. And I think the companies who do it successfully tend to go for, if you like, a remote first approach to the culture, right, rather than an office first. So you really have to make sure that the people who are remote don't perceive themselves as being disconnected from, you know, the key conversations that are going on in the organization.
Yeah, we've a couple of journalists who prefer to work from home or outside the offices. One of my colleagues, John Mulligan, mostly works from home, and he prefers it that way, and he's at least as productive as the rest of us. I mean, it's great stories. He does a lot in aviation and a lot on business. I wanted to ask you, Brian, you're very plugged into not only the VC community here, but also the startup community. I've been reporting this week on a couple of companies that have closed funding rounds, but what's the climate like right now for raising money, or for those companies who have raised money?
So I think the overall climate is very, very tough, very, very difficult indeed. There's a kind of a small cohort of companies for whom it'll remain reasonably easy to raise money, primarily because they're kind of targeting the virtualization of a physical interaction or they're targeting support for remote work, you know. So a couple of companies that I'm involved in as a, as an angel investor, Robotify and Boundless kind of fall into that category. Mm-hmm. And
so it's, you know, that's Adam Dalton and Eamon Leonard, is it?
Adam Dalton, yep. And Evan are the founders of Robotify, and actually Dee Coakley, Eamon, yeah. Leonard and Emily Castles are the founders of Boundless. So I mean those companies are finding it reasonably straightforward and are being able to close additional funding, but I think the broader picture is much, much bleaker than that. And you know, for example, I was on a conference call just recently for a fund where I'm an LP, and the kind of the very, very clear writing instructions to the management team was like, no more new investments, guys. You know, we need to make sure we reserve the capital that we have to support the existing portfolio companies, because they are likely to be hurting big time and to need additional capital. So I think we're going to see a period of time where most institutional investors, even if they aren't honest about saying it, will be very, very reluctant to make new investments unless they have a brand new, freshly minted fund. But if they've got an existing portfolio, they're going to be focused on, you know, what are we going to need to do to support those companies? So I think we're facing into a very, very difficult time from a fundraising perspective.
And from that community's point of view, when you're part of those discussions, what is the time frame that you're thinking about, or that is commonly thought of, for how long this will continue under those conditions?
I think people are thinking that it's kind of 3 to 6 months. I'd argue that it's going to be very much longer than that, because there are, you know, quite significant macroeconomic impacts. You know, a lot of the investors in venture capital funds are, for example, pension funds who allocate a tiny percentage of their overall assets to VC, because their stock market holdings have collapsed in value, the percentage in VC has grown. So they won't be making new investments in VC until that percentage comes back into balance. So I think that we could be facing a difficult environment from a funding perspective, actually for several years because of those impacts.
And our, lastly, on that point, did the government wage support schemes, I've read in other countries there have been, not criticism, but there have been difficulties with that from a startup perspective in the UK and in Canada, largely because the various criteria don't really suit startup. For example, they'll only apply to profitable companies, or they'll apply to, for example, what your monthly revenue was 12 months ago, which... the way sometimes the metrics that tech companies use sometimes don't rhyme, don't tally specifically with that. Might there be a problem here with that?
I think there certainly are issues. In fairness to the Department of Finance and the Revenue Commissioners, they have made it clear that they want the existing schemes to be accessible to startups and to tech businesses. But in particular for early stage companies, we still have to clarify exactly how that's going to operate. You know, wearing my Scale Ireland hat, we're in very active discussions with Enterprise Ireland and others in terms of, you know, how we're going to bridge this gap. But yes, there are definitely issues in terms of the eligibility of startup companies because of the nature of the criteria.
Hmm. And Catherine, what about your part of the industry? I mean, privacy, we've touched on it once or twice now, but and it's not going to go away. We saw, for example, the Data Protection Commissioner just a few days ago came out with a report, which I thought, by the way, wasn't picked up nearly enough, absolutely slamming a whole variety of companies over the issue of cookies, media companies, banks, healthcare companies in particular, really, really hard. So there are definitely still issues there. And she's effectively given us all 6 months to get our act together. I don't think that we'll all get our act together, but that's the
well,
the,
in truth, the scale. We've had several years to get our act together on that specific issue. Yeah. So, the 6 months is another extension on that.
But from your point of view, then, so we're talking about the rest of industry. There's a very serious recession maybe on the way. Will that affect the privacy consultancy business?
It'll affect any consulting business. We're in an interesting situation at the moment because, naturally, a lot of ongoing projects that weren't seen as, absolutely critical to functioning have been put on the back burner right now. But in the meantime, we're seeing a lot of very, very quick new things cropping up that require privacy review because they're absolutely essential parts of, again, looking at medical information, for instance. We're ending up doing a lot of quick and dirty research impact assessments, trying to see how people can best solve the problems that they're facing right now. So it's an odd mix. It's a rocky road, but privacy doesn't go away just because there's a crisis. And in a situation like right now, privacy and your fundamental human rights in general, again, when you're talking data protection, you are not just talking privacy, you're talking making sure that when you use data, it is governed properly to ensure that we're properly considering effects on people's fundamental human rights. That includes the right to health. So it's making sure that we can meet those goals in the best way possible, getting the right data and using it the right way. That's absolutely essential to making sure that we do things right now in this crisis.
There is this risk of a creep, isn't there? Like we're seeing a contact tracing app being discussed. There's all sorts of proposals for how companies might help. Like, for example, I wrote a piece about a month ago about what we could do before there was a contract tracing. And one of the suggestions, it was only really back of the envelope, but was to suggest that people who had contracted COVID-19 might, if it was helpful, volunteer themselves their own Google location history themselves on a totally voluntary basis to try and help authorities. I had a to and fro with Bobby Healy, the Man of Aero entrepreneur, good guy. He's a lot more gung-ho about that. He was arguing that maybe there is a case to be made for Google to hand over everybody's location data, which would be kind of an extreme reaction. But my question, the reason I'm bringing it up is my question is, and because you referred to it, the balance and how we should consider that line between maintaining privacy and when does a situation get urgent enough for us to start making compromise. We have already made a few compromises. Data Protection Commissioner and other European commissioners have said we can make further compromises. I'm not sure it goes all the way up to Google handing over everybody's location data, but where will it go and where should it stop?
So that's a couple of things. Again, data protection law in Europe is specifically designed to require you to think ahead and decide what's the goal we're trying to meet, what data is necessary and proportionate for that goal, and what is the balance and trade-off of risks and harms. There are actually in GDPR specific lawful conditions under which you can process very sensitive medical information, for instance. And so there is a lawful basis to do so. The main thing that you're looking at, for instance, the Google GPS data type of a question, whether you're looking at getting it from Google Maps or whether you're looking at getting it from telecoms, first question is, what question are you trying to answer? Second question is it fit for purpose? So what turns out to be the case, and Google spokespeople have actually come out and said this in regards to Google location data, it's not accurate enough for the purpose of contact tracing. It will give you, you know, for instance, you know, your location is accurate to maybe 7 to 30 meters. They're not quite sure. Depends on the on your reception, depends on a whole bunch of variables. If we're talking 30 meters, that's a person self-isolating across the street from me. So it doesn't give you adequate information for contact tracing.
Although it could go to providing some clarity, for example, whether the stay-at-home measures are working. That, I mean, that was what I got from Google's data last week, was they were able to say there's 83% fewer visits to retail locations, which suggests that most people are actually abiding by the government's instructions. So that might be helpful.
And that they can do without giving personal data. You can aggregate up and give statistical data. So yeah, that's something that telecoms are already lawfully able to do. And if you're not giving specific granular data as to people's locations, it's not as much of a privacy issue. So it's, again, figuring out what is the actual requirement that we need? How can we best meet that requirement?
Yeah, and I think it's worth pointing out that the kind of contact tracing apps that are being proposed are not using location data. They are fundamentally privacy preserving, because what they're designed to do is to enable the exchange of a token between two phones that have been in very close proximity for some defined period of time. Those tokens are stored on the device and are only accessed with the permission of the owner of the device in the event that they are identified as a confirmed case or a likely case. And in that situation, it enormously facilitates the identification of people with whom that person has been in contact. And it also facilitates the notification of people anonymously that they have been in close contact with a confirmed case. And, you know, I think one of the dangers here is that we end up not doing something that would be potentially enormously beneficial because of, frankly, overblown fears in relation to the privacy implications of the technology that's being deployed. And misinformation, you know, I mean, the explanation that I've just given you is great for people with some understanding of the technologies involved. It's not going to be an accessible explanation to an awful lot of people who may choose not to adopt such a technology, because of, if you like, unwarranted fears about the privacy implications of the technology, and that kind of worries me. The other thing that's kind of worth saying is that anything that's being proposed, certainly in an Irish context, is opt-in.
It doesn't actually have to be, which is kind of an interesting thing, but again, the example of the Bluetooth contact tracing apps, you're absolutely correct there. And we've done several reviews in the past couple of weeks on, for instance, things like the Singapore Trace Together app, which uses Bluetooth technology. It does not collect any information as to location at all. All it does is it measures proximity between your phone running the app and another person's phone running the app. So, you know, it basically says, okay, these two phones got this close together for this period of time at this time. That information is pseudonymized, so and it's kept on the device. So it's very well designed from what's called a privacy by design perspective, which is what European data protection laws require you to do. So there might be some improvements to be made on that particular app. Again, are we going to send this information to a centralized database if you are identified as having come into contact with someone who's infected? Or are we going to give you a push notification to say, contact this hotline? That doesn't actually have to go to a database. These are, again, design questions that have to be considered in the planning stages, so you build the right thing to answer the question you want to answer.
Yeah, that Trace Together app, by the way, that's in the Irish App Store. It's pretty useless mm-hmm. because I think you have to have a Singaporean address.
The design of the Singapore app does basically require to register to get put into their database of this phone has this phone number. If that particular phone comes into contact with someone who's been identified as COVID-19 positive, then you get rung by the Singapore health authorities. So it's not useful for Irish people unless they're registered in Singapore. So not particularly useful there, but it has been the basis for a lot of other possible designs. And it's something that the European Commission is looking at for a harmonized approach. European Data Protection Supervisor is looking at making sure that across Europe we develop the right type of app, and it can be interoperable across Europe. So it's, again, trying to get the best solution for what we need.
Yeah, and I think the, the type of apps that are being proposed in Ireland are very much along the lines of the Singapore app. And unfortunately, the Singaporean government went back and forth for several weeks on whether they would open source the code for that app or not. Mm-hmm. Initially, they just published some design information. I think yesterday, mm-hmm. in fact, they finally did make the code available, which is good, a good thing. But most governments have taken the view that they needed to plow ahead and couldn't kind of wait for the Singaporean government to kind of make their minds up. The one thing I would say is that we need to make sure that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater here, and that where there are processes that need to happen from a data protection perspective, but they need to be done quickly. They need to be paralleled with development of the technology. And, at the end of the day, lives are at stake,
Data protection, what it's useful here is actually getting it done quickly right. Because if you spend all your time designing the wrong thing and you get bad information, you end up with as much of a problem as if you took, if you did do the due diligence and took an extra day. Largely a lot of the review we've been doing has been very, very quick, but it's back of the envelope. Here's the way you need to think about the data flows and making sure that we are answering the right questions.
I mean, I take Brian's point. That was in the back mm-hmm. of my mind as well with this question. For example, the contact tracing app that we're considering at the moment, there'll be a lot of analysis among data privacy experts as to whether or not there has been a data protection impact assessment and all that sort of stuff. And yet it does strike me that so we had say 30 deaths the other day. Now if we were at 1,000 deaths a day, I don't think we would be spending that much time on a DPIA, and I don't even think it would be as big a consideration. So I'm trying to get a sense of where we are in the urgency of of process.
I think in terms of the urgency, the first thing to understand about these tracing apps is that their real value is when we release the restrictions on movement again.
Agreed.
When we're all locked in our homes to all intents and purposes, the tracing apps aren't hugely important because you're just not in contact with anyone. So that does give us a little bit of a window to get things right in as many respects as we can.
I'm quite positive that we are on the road to getting it done right. So
I agree.
I do wonder, well, finish off now, but I do wonder when this is over, whether or not the guards and maybe some others as well might have become fairly comfortable with the idea of, maybe setting up more roadblocks or maybe, having a little bit more power and control over things. I mean, I was in an unusual position where I had to do a doorstep of Drew Harris, the guard, the commissioner, about a month ago, something completely unrelated. And I asked him out of nowhere, did he support other governments' calls for a back door into Apple's iMessage? This is the kind of thing that they always call for. to fight terrorism or child abduction or lots of noble reasons, but it's kind of a fraught idea. He said, yeah, he liked the idea, you know, he wish it was available. And you can see why, you know, authorities might like to, just that might be the option of being able to enforce things a little with a little bit more, maybe more of a continental style, you know, the way whereas a gendarme can stop you and just and say, show me your papers, kind of apropos of nothing. And we just don't have that culture and that history here. So I do wonder, after this is over, will there be any kind of
well, if you look at Irish there? History there and that state of war and emergency powers, we do have a history of being in a state of war for a lot longer than World War II was in existence.
Oh, the Defence Against the State Act. Defence Against the State Act. Brian, you remember this. I mean, for about when I was growing up, 80s, 90s, the Offences Against the State Act was used for every second offence that you heard on the TV in the 6 o'clock news has been detained under the Offences Against the State Act.
Yeah. So these are things that we're already aware of as risk. And that is why, you know, privacy and human rights advocates are trying very, very hard to remind us that, you know, a crisis is when human rights are more important than any other time, because it's when people are, you know, the vulnerable people who are at risk become at most risk. And it's very, very difficult to claw back any sort of, you know, states of abuse that we've entered into. So that's why it's really important to get it done right now.
Yeah, I think the reality is that these things are always a balance, you know, and I think in terms of things like the backdoor into iMessage, you know, we have to recognize that there are scenarios where somebody's human rights are being infringed because that's not available, right? So you're always talking about a balance of various rights. And, you know, I'm not sure we do a great job of getting that balance right all the time. I think the culture of policing in Ireland is generally a very good one. You know, the vast majority of policing is kind of policing by consent, and I think that kind of stands to us greatly in a scenario like we're in at the moment. But anytime you give somebody additional power or new powers, their instinct is to hold on to that power, you know. So I'm certainly in favor of kind of sunset clauses on kind of additional powers that might be well be necessary in the short term.
I'm not going to test it this week. Again, as you can see, I'm in Dublin. I'm not in down Mayo or anywhere else. I'm not running that gamut.
And I know how much you love Mayo, Adrian. Like, that's a huge sacrifice.
And even though I was telling Catherine this, technically, we could load the car up, right? Not stop at a shop, drive point to point to that cottage, never get out of the car and do the same on the way back. And yet, that is still kind of irresponsible to do that, because what you're really doing is you're kind of saying, no, these strictures that society is taking upon, they don't necessarily apply to me, because I am capable of you know, of acting otherwise, sensibly. So it's just not worth it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think generally the community cohesion that we've had in Ireland and the fact that the majority of us are absolutely willing to take that personal responsibility and stay at home because it's protecting our loved ones, it's protecting all of us as a society. It's good to see.
Yeah. Just before we go, Brian, you're participating, is it in a business survival webinar next Thursday, April 15th, I think, are you, with Jamie Heaslip and the Republic of Work?
That's right. I think it's Wednesday the 15th at 6:30 in the evening. So should be fun.
Yeah. And how, if people wanted to log on to that, how would they?
There's a sign-up page on Eventbrite. I think if you search Built in Cork on Twitter, you'll find a link to it there. Or if you go to Eventbrite and search.
Bunch of Dubliners on that telling Cork people what to do.
Yeah. Well, in fairness, Jamie Heaslip, I don't think is strictly a Dubliner. Born in Israel and raised in Kildare, I think. So I'm not sure what he is.
Well, listen, thank you very much for joining this video podcast. Brian Caulfield, venture partner, Draper Esprit, Catherine O'Keefe of Castle Bridge. Been great having you on. Been very generous with your time. Some really good opinions there. And from me, Adrian Weckler, I will have the really good camera kit next week. So you'll be seeing that beautiful natural blur, not the fake stuff from Skype in the background, thanks to the 2.8 lens. But for me, for now, bye-bye, and I'll talk to you next week.